Greetings once again to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends, students, and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. This is your navigator, John Lash, recording for a second time on the morning of June 3rd, 2013. This is the first nav briefing in the 70 series, and the title is The Beauty of Persephone. I'm recording this briefing in the pre-dawn hours with the crescent moon rising over the horizon to the east. That would be, of course, the sunrise crescent or the left-hand crescent. So if you hold up your left hand and you cup the thumb and finger into a crescent, that is the shape of the round of the sunrise crescent. Whereas the shape of the round of the sunset crescent is imitated by the right hand. And of course, in planetary tantra, consistent with the observation of the Dakini shifts, sunrise crescent is the signal or omen of completion. I've spoken often of these rituals performed in the last 3 or 4 days of a Dakini shift. And you could say I'm in a sort of ritual of that kind right now as I speak. I'm in completion with Kematsu at the moment of recording this briefing. I have to say that it's been so far, and continues to be until Saturday, which would be the final day of the shift, a magnificent, sweet, and enriching journey under the instruction of Kematsu, who combines the earth goddess Bhudevi with the wrathful green Tara. I've not been able to appreciate the wavelength of this Dakini period until now, not really deeply and intimately, as I've been able to do in the last 20-odd days. I mentioned that the instruction of Kematsu is mingled with ordinary reflection and even with ordinary emotion. It's a gentle and accessible frequency compared to the rather staccato, high-velocity delivery of some Gaia Dakinis. The instruction of Kematsu concentrates largely on the themes of fate and fortune, which are complementary and concordant themes. Never think of one without the other. Fate and fortune, as well as the theme of abundance. Bhudevi, or Bhuvaneshvari, who is a desideristic goddess of the Shakti cluster, that is to say, of the 10 Dravidian goddesses in Sri Vidya mysticism, is a goddess like Lakshmi of abundance and richness, and that is material abundance, wealth, luxury, privilege. Traditionally, the followers of the 10 Mahavidyas of Sri Vidya mysticism claim that Bhudevi grants all your material desires. Now, this is an interesting claim, isn't it? And I've been reflecting a lot on the desideristic aspect of planetary tantra during this shift. And I've been thinking about abundance and how to attract it, and why it's there when it's there, and why it's not there when it's not. I could say that I've been contemplating abundance throughout this entire shift. And the Dakini instruction that's been drifting in and out of my mind, wafting in my mind, you could say, has brought some considerable and ever-deepening insights on that subject. In the last few briefings, I introduced the theme of Arya, meaning nobility, and the theme of Arete, meaning excellence. I'm not sure how to pronounce the Greek word Arete. Perhaps it's Arete. Arete, excellence, and Arya, nobility, are of course closely related words, and they both refer in turn to the theme of abundance. The nobility of the human animal consists in its capacity to recognize and receive abundance. And the excellence of the human animal consists in its capacity to use abundance correctly, to use wealth correctly. One of the first inklings of a Dakini instruction I got at the beginning of this shift came in this way. Well, it came in the form of a general observation that is almost a cliche. You may have heard this observation numerous times on the internet or in public discourse. I certainly have heard it numerous times. The observation is that there's plenty for everyone here on this planet. It's just the problem of distribution. So there's plenty of water, there's plenty of air, there's plenty of food, there's plenty of everything for the population of 6.5 billion people, 6.5 human animals to live here. But it doesn't appear to be so because the distribution is so screwed up. So the sharing of abundance is one of the themes of the shift. And human animals show their excellence by the way in which they share. And human societies show their excellence by the way in which they arrange the distribution of the resources of that society among its members. These are beautiful and simple concepts that might point to a sane picture of how human animals can behave. So in a general, in a loose sense, these have been some of my reflections. But more specifically, there's a deeper current of contemplation within the Kematsu shift. And I am certain that it is this deeper current that has brought to focus the subject I discussed in the previous briefing, the topic I discussed at the end of that briefing. In the context of the fourth task of Psyche in the legend of Eros and Psyche, something comes to mind, something comes to your attention. And I want to assure you that if you can hold your attention steadily on that item, on that issue, it can lead to some extraordinary moments of knowledge. The beauty of Persephone is the theme of this talk. Beauty of Persephone is what? Well, to move into the subject, I would say that the beauty of Persephone can be approached in two aspects. One is the beauty of the mythic image of womanhood that carries the name of Persephone, the queen of the night, the bride of Hades. And the other is an immense transcendental realization that looms behind that image of woman. The beauty of Persephone is not only the beauty of the form and figure and story of Persephone, but also of a transcendental reality behind her, a transcendental reality of your own mind that you come to encounter through this mythological figure. Now, I've taken this occasion to record a reading of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice in the revised version that can be found on metahistory.org. And you may note the date of that posting. The Turton's revision of the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice, which gives it a different ending, was written almost exactly 5 years ago. It was actually written spontaneously in an afternoon in the Grenier in Belgium, where I often visit and where I lived for many years, off and on. I think I posted the written form of it on the 11th of June. I think it was actually written on the 3rd, 4th, 5th, or 6th of June. And it was written in a spontaneous rush without any reflection, planning, or plotting. So you can go and read that myth, or you can listen to my reading of it if you like. In that story, you'll find a description of Persephone, of her physical being, of her bearing, of the color of her skin, the way she wears her hair, the color of her eyes, of the jewelry she wears, and of the way that she behaves in the presence of Orpheus and of her king and husband, Hades. All of those factors and features apply to the mythological image or mythic image of Persephone. But I have said, I am proposing that there is a transcendent realization of yourself in your own mind, contained within that image, or looming behind it, if you will, looming through it. So let's see in the course of this briefing if I can reveal exactly what that transcendent realization is. To return for a moment to the classical material from Apuleius, recall that the young girl Psyche faced four tests. And of these, the fourth one is clearly and distinctly of a different character than the others. In the first three, Psyche receives assistance, help, and advice. In the fourth task, she also receives advice and guidance and specific directions from a mysterious presence in the earth described as a tower. But the fourth task is unique and stands quite distinct from the others in that Psyche is required to carry it out on her own. So I have indicated my view that the fourth task represents something that happens to the aeons of fire in a post-intercession moment. So let's go back and look at the details of this fourth episode again and see how it might be decoded. In the fourth task, Aphrodite demands that Psyche descend into the underworld, into Hades, the realm of Pluto, being the Latin term for Hades, and of his bride, Proserpina in Latin, Persephone in Greek. The purpose of going into that realm, which is the realm of the dead, where no living person can actually enter or survive for very long, is to request from Persephone some beauty ointment, a portion of her beauty. And Psyche is supposed to bring this back and give it to Aphrodite. Well, with the advice given to her by the High Tower, whatever that may be, Psyche accomplishes her terrifying mission. I'm reading here from the paraphrase in Ariadne's Clue. But having returned from the underworld, she succumbs to an impulse to steal some of the ointment so as to win once more the grace of her fair lover. When she opens the casket, there was no beauty therein, nor anything at all, save a hellish and truly Stygian sleep. Psyche falls to the ground and lies motionless, no better than a sleeping corpse. She falls into a stupor. Now, as we are noting the difference between this task and the previous three, here's a further point of difference. And I think this would be perhaps the most striking and remarkable point. In the three previous tasks, Psyche faced difficult challenges which seemed impossible at first. The challenges required that she reach inaccessible regions or undertake some immense and minutely detailed exercise, such as sorting all of the different seeds in the first task. But in the fourth task, you could say that the challenge lies in Psyche's perception of herself. And this factor of self-perception doesn't play in the other three incidents, does it? So the theme that emerges here by decoding this legend is the theme of the self-perception of Psyche, which is to say, the self-perception of the Aeon Sophia. How does she perceive herself? How can she perceive herself? The self-perception of Gaia. How does she perceive herself? If Gaia knows that she is an aeon and that the material body of the planet is her body, what is her concept of herself? Think about yourself. You walk around as a consciousness and identity upon the face of this earth. You have a body and you look down, you see your body. But your body does not comprise your sense of yourself, does it? The body is included in your sense of yourself, but your self-perception, that is to say, the awareness of having a self at all, is something that is not contained or limited by your awareness of having a body. Well, could the same be true of the Aeon Sophia? If it is true, then the legend would appear to indicate that something crucial happened to the Aeon in her perception of herself as the planetary mother, or mother planet, if you will. She sees herself as a mother planet the way that you look down and see yourself with a body. But how does she see herself as a self? Well, although the details in this fourth episode are not extensive, it appears that something radical changes in her perception of herself due to the departure of the Aeos, of the Aeon Christos. During the time of the intercession, she is not alone anymore with the earth and as the earth, is she? She is collaborating closely with another Aeon, another being, another force that has the same power and status as she has. She has the company of an Aeon. And when the Christos departs, she has an identity crisis. Apuleius indicates this skillfully. He uses the quaint fairy tale motif of a young girl feeling insecure when she's lost her lover. She cannot access her lover as long as she is facing the challenges posed by Aphrodite. Eros being the son of Aphrodite in the structure of this fable. So Aphrodite keeps Psyche from being reunited with her divine lover Eros. And during that time, she feels inadequate. She begins to wonder if she has sufficient beauty to reattract him. This is these details of the fairy tale genre of this legend indicate the emotions of the Aeon Sophia in the wake of intercession. And so, as the story goes, once she has attained a portion of the beauty of Persephone, symbolically represented as ointment carried in a casket or in a jar, she decides to open it, contrary to the specific instructions of the high tower. She decides to open it and take some out. But when she opens it, she falls into a deep stupor. What is that stupor that ensues from the Christic intercession? I think the answer to that question is not difficult to see, knowing what we know of the mother planet today. I've often said that Gaia is autistic. Do you remember that? I myself was shocked when I learned this. How did I learn it? I learned it by observing her. The planetary animal mother is like any other animal. We just have to observe the behavior of the animal to understand its mindset. So I observe my cats. I observe the way they walk around the terrace, the way they play. I observe the way they stand on the roof and look around and sniff. And from observing the way they behave, I infer their mind and their habits. In those initial sessions on Infinity Ridge, beginning in the year 2002, by observing the planetary animal mother in an altered state, I came to understand that she's autistic. If there are 5 or 6 children playing in a room, and you're a good observer, you'll be able to pick out the child that is autistic. So this is nothing extraordinary. This is nothing even particularly mystical. But, of course, I made that observation by entering into her dreaming to the point where I could see how her dreaming operates and what is her sense of self within her own dreaming. Now, what happened as a result of the Christic intercession was a kind of division of labor in Sophia's dreaming. Before the Aeon Christos arrived, Sophia required the totality of her second attention in order to manage the activities of her first attention. In other words, her first attention was not able to function independently of her second attention. The two faculties were mingled. And this is an inefficient situation, as it would be for any animal. It would be the same for you. Fortunately, your first and second attentions are separated and able to operate independently. In fact, there is even a sub-function of the first attention which allows you to go on automatic with the first attention so that your second attention can function in parallel while your first attention is up and running. An example of that, the most obvious example, is driving a car. You need to use your first attention actively in order to learn how to drive a car. But once you've learned, you can fall back on the low gear of your first attention, on the sub-function, which is a certain type of subconscious automatism. So after you've learned how to drive a car, by direct application of your first attention, then you can rely on your first attention kicking in to an automatic or semi-automatic gear. And that is the subconscious function of your first attention. And when you allow the subconscious function of your first attention to take over, you smoothly and automatically and confidently drive the car without giving a lot of your attention to it. And then you can allow your second attention to flow. That is why it's a pleasure to drive, sometimes even on long drives, because you can dream and think and meditate. You can have extended reverie, that is to say, the elaboration of your second attention, extended reverie and extended memory. But you can see in that analogy that the functions remain absolutely distinct. You cannot mix up the dreaming and reverie and recall process in your mind with the automatic functions of driving. You can't mingle them. Well, in the beginning, before the intercession, the massive activities of Sophia's first attention required to run the physical planet, and the massive activity of her dreaming, which brought her into existence as a planet, were in a massa confusa, to use the alchemical term. They were mingled together and confounded in a non-sustainable manner. So, in the first 3 tasks described in the legend of Eros and Psyche, Christos assisted the Aeon Sophia in separating out the activities of her first attention and to some degree rendering them not fully automatic, because there is nothing fully automatic in nature, but semi-automatic. So, for instance, take the first task Many species of insects, ants and bugs and flying insects, dragonflies and bees, are continuously involved in micromanaging the habitat. Isn't that true? This happens because Christos and Sophia set it up that way during the intercession. Consequently, many of the micro tasks required to sustain the terrestrial environment do not rely on Sophia's immediate attention at the level of her first attention. Nor do they rely on her dreaming, but they function in a semi-automatic manner. I emphasize that word, and I highlight the term semi-automatic. Nothing is really totally or purely automatic in the material immanence of the Aeon Sophia. She sustains every single event at every moment, perpetually, by her dreaming power. But the different realms of physical reality, biological, geological realities that she sustains are delegated into certain categories so that some of it proceeds semi-automatically. So it cannot say that the Aeon Sophia totally controls with her dreaming the flight of the ladybug that lands on your shoulder. The flight of the ladybug is semi-automatic in her first attention, because it was set up that way, A, so she could free herself from the overwhelming task of micromanagement, and B, so that she could bring the power of her second attention into engagement with what is happening on the earth. If you want to understand what semi-automatic is, just take the example of your own breathing. Your own breathing is semi-automatic. You don't have to think about breathing in order to breathe, do you? But if something happens to you, if you fall down, if something knocks your breath away, you immediately make your breathing voluntary. It's no longer semi-automatic. It becomes totally voluntary. You take your breath back. Or you can do breathing exercises. That is to say, you can put your breathing, you can switch your breathing from a semi-automatic mode to a fully voluntary mode. But your breathing is never on a fully automatic mode. And while you can count on your breathing being semi-automatic and thank the goddess for that, you can be damn sure that you will notice the instant in which there is anything that does not operate properly or correctly in that semi-automatism of breathing, won't you? And then you'll bring in conscious and voluntary action to correct it. She needs to have the same degree of latitude and liberty in the management of those processes of the biosphere in the material planet that engage her first attention. What then is she doing with her second attention simultaneous to that vast realm of activities? Well, in her second attention, the mother planet is occupied primarily with two courses of activity. The first one is that she maintains continually in her second attention the picture of the earth which she is. The second attention is the seat of her self-perception. And so, like an artist painting, standing in front of a huge canvas with paintbrushes, she not only strokes the paint onto the canvas, but she watches the picture she is painting as it emerges. So she continually watches the clouds, but she cannot watch anything passively. So as she watches clouds, she is actually dreaming the activity of those clouds. To a certain degree, some of the processes in the biosphere are semi-automatic, but some of, and they are delegated, therefore, to the first attention, as I just described. But simultaneously, some of the processes in the biosphere, particularly atmospheric processes, like the jet stream, the formation and dissolution of clouds, the evaporation of seawater, photosynthesis, these types of massive planetary atmospheric processes are sustained directly by her dreaming, as is the tides, as is the motion of the water. So she is engaged in the artwork of life on this planet through her second attention and dreaming. And that is the part of her second attention that is, let us say, totally occupied by material immanence. But at the same time, she is an aeon. She is a torrent of organic light from the pleromic center, and she has a self-consciousness of being an aeon. And so the other part of her second attention is occupied with that mysterious factor, self-consciousness. Now, it might seem like a really impossible challenge to bring your mind to conceive what the self-consciousness of the mother planet is like. What is her self-consciousness of herself? How does she form it? How does she maintain it? But I can assure you of something that is so simple that it is almost impossible to believe because it is so simple. What is that? It is the fact that she experiences the Aeon Sophia in material immanence as this planet, experiences the consciousness of self in exactly the same way that you do. Now, as far as I know, that's a first. That statement is a first. The entire consciousness of the planet Earth, of the superorganism of Gaia, when you attribute to it the capacity to be conscious, invites you to go to the next step and attribute to it the capacity to be self-conscious. And what I'm saying is that the very same process, if you will, the very same activity that allows you to see yourself as a self allows her to do the same. Now, that is quite a large notion, isn't it? And there is a name for that notion, actually. That notion that I just articulated is not my invention. There is a name or word for what I just described. It's a Sanskrit word, but it also exists in Greek and can be found in the Nag Hammadi cosmological writings. Now, it so happens that in English, the English language, there is no single word for this activity that produces the consciousness of self, that supports the consciousness of self. And the best that can be done in English is to use a phrase that describes the result of this power. So be really clear on what I'm saying here. There's a power that is of a cosmic nature that permeates the entire universe. And this power, which can be given a name in Sanskrit and a name in Greek, does not have a name in English. But the result of this power, the result of its capacity to confer selfhood, can be expressed in a phrase. And that phrase is the beauteous form of the self. So what produces the beauteous form of the self? Well, it's a power that is universally present everywhere that anything exists. And it is the same power at every level of existence. And it is called, in the tantric cosmology and metaphysics of Asia, Mahamaya. Mahamaya. Now, Maha means great, and Maya means not illusion, but apparition. An apparition is not an illusion. An illusion is an error. An illusion is a mistake. It is seeing something that is not there or seeing what is there wrongly. For instance, it is an illusion of the human animal to see the planet Earth as dead matter, to see it as inert, to see material as inert, is an illusion. It is not an apparition. The apparition is to see any material at all. You see the difference? So never mistake apparition, Maya, with illusion. Mahamaya is the great apparition. And what is the great apparition? Well, it is the beauteous form of the self. And Mahamaya is the power that produces the apparition of yourself. You have a sense of being a self, and so does the mother planet. And both of those senses of self have the same source. Can you get your mind around that? And so it is completely wrong, metaphysically and in any extension of human syntax and conceptualization in psychology and metapsychology, it is totally wrong to say that the self is an illusion. The self is no illusion. Oh no. The beauteous form of the self is a product of the love and abundance of the universe itself, the universe beyond self, produces the beauteous form of the self. And that is your subjective awareness of who you are and Gaia's of who she is. Now let me elaborate on this a little further. It may seem far and away from the episode, the fourth episode in the legend of Eros and Psyche. It may seem far away from the glamorous persona of Persephone. But that will come around again. You can be sure of that. I just want to weave this particular lesson in this particular way. in the Gnostic Coptic writings, about one in every four or five words is Greek. Scholars argue that the Coptic writings of the Nag Hammadi books are translations from Greek originals which have been lost. Well, whether or not they were translations from Greek originals, Greek words occur in Coptic vocabulary. One of those words is monogenes. M-O-N-O-G-E-N-E-S. The theological translation of monogenes is only begotten. Mono meaning only or singular, and genes meaning begotten. So those Christian scholars and those Coptic experts whose minds have been formed by a Judeo-Christian education routinely translate monogenes in Gnostic cosmology as only begotten. I translate it as singularity. So the originator, which is the unity, power, and ground of all the galaxies that stands beyond the aeons, the one called the unknowable God, the unknowable aeon by the Gnostics, the originator produces singularities. And each of these singularities arises from the originator and passes to the aeons or generators. And the generosity of the originator is that it allows the aeons to elaborate that singularity of pure and unique potential. And that is what they do. They generate experiments and creatures from the singularities provided by the originator. This is Gnostic cosmology in absolutely bare bones expression. Now, there occurs another Greek term, one of the quintessential terms of Gnostic cosmology, found in the Coptic writings, and that is autogenes. A-U-T-O-G-E-N-E-S. Now, what is autogenes? Well, once again, scholars following the prejudice of their religious indoctrinations tend to say the self-begotten. Auto, self, genes, begotten. And in doing so, their translations fall into the mire of religious and theological speculation. But I say that the word autogenes in Greek is the exact equivalent of Mahamaya. Remember that Mahamaya is the universal power that produces the apparition of a self. Autogenes can be translated as self-generating, therefore, that which generates the self. Therefore, I submit to you that autogenes and Mahamaya are two words for the same power. Now, to elaborate on this a little further, I'm not going to go into the Gnostic Coptic library, which I have staring me in the face here, all five volumes of it, on the shelf above my computer, because the citations that I could provide would be fragmentary, jumbled, confusing, and confounding compared to that mess of pottage which is called the Nag Hammadi library. Descriptions of the Mahamaya autogenes power that you can find in Hindu tantric writings are far more lucid and accessible. Now, I find that I have not been able, in 5 years since I received the term of Gaia Awakening, to actually transmit or teach Kala Tantra. Kala Tantra is part of the Terma. It came along with Planetary Tantra. But due to the circumstances of fate and fortune, I don't have an abundance of opportunities to teach Kala Tantra. You see, I'm talking in the language of the Kematsu shift, right? And so what I did was a sneaky maneuver. Attached to these poems, which are conversions of the poems of William Butler Yeats, hence the Yeats conversions, I added commentaries. And in these commentaries, I had the pretext to expound on certain aspects of Kala Tantra. And in fact, even in the poems themselves, one particular one, which is called The Holy Mantis, and actually quite a few others, you can find actual tantric instruction in the practices and principles of Kala Tantra, because I couldn't put them out in any other way. That's where they stand so far. For instance, there's a poem called Spain and Scotland. And in the footnotes to this poem, which uses the line, the beauteous form of the self, you'll find this entry. The beauteous form of the self, in Sanskrit, Mahamaya. The frame of infinite beholding that causes a experience to appear to be viewed by an individual witness, be it an amoeba, an elephant, or a human person. See notes on Holy Mantis. Did you catch that? The frame of infinite beholding that causes experience to appear to be viewed by an individual witness. You see, you don't merely perceive the world subjectively like an individual witness, that is to say, a subjective self looking at the world, because you have a body. It's not your body that gives you the sense of being a self. It's Mahamaya. It's not the material body of the earth that gives the Aeon Sophia her self-consciousness either. It's the same power, Mahamaya, or in Greek, autogenes. And the autogenes emanates directly from the originator. Now, as I just said not too long ago, the metaphysics of all this, if you will, the metaphysical syntax, if you will, can't be found in the Coptic cosmological writings, except in a fragmentary and jumbled form. But when you go to the writings and teachings of Hindu Tantra, and also what is called Kashmiri Shaivism, well, there you find it. And when you go to the notes of the Yeats translations, you find something even better, if I may say so myself, which is the distillation of all of that Hindu tantric teaching into concise, clear and concise syntax. And so in the notes to the poem entitled The Holy Mantis, again, there is a definition of Mahamaya. And the notes say, in Hindu Tantra, Mahashakti, is the term for the inscrutable power of Shri to generate the manifest worlds in full-blown materiality, concrete and sensorial. So there is something called Shri or Shri Shiva. That would be the originator, okay? Literally, Shri Shiva means blessed, pure beholding. So the originator is, if you want to use the word, passive. The originator doesn't do anything but behold. Although its beholding is a cosmic act of love. The originator beholds, and it delegates to a power that emanates from itself called Maya Shakti. It delegates to that power the generation of actual manifest material worlds. It doesn't produce illusions. It's no more interested in sitting back and looking at illusions and errors and phantoms of perception than you are. It wants to experience worlds that are real, with real creatures in them. And so, the originator, the ground awareness of the entire universe, operates through its Shakti, or female part, to generate these manifest worlds, which are material emanations and material appearances. The planet Earth is a material appearance generated by the Aeon Sophia, but the fact that she can generate it is due to having the power of Mahashakti as an Aeon, and the power of Mahashakti comes from the originator, you see? So there's a delegation of powers. Now, in the classical writings of the Gnostics, most of which are lost and burned, it appears that the Gnostic scholars and cosmologists elaborated wildly on these delegations of levels of power and consciousness, which were called hypostasis. And the Christian heresy hunters who hated the Gnostics used to ridicule them for the complexity of this system. But what I'm telling you isn't complex. What I'm saying now is as simple as it gets, and I dare say as it will ever get when it comes to anything approaching a metaphysical syntax. The footnote on Mahamaya, attached to the poem, The Holy Mantis, continues. Additional to the inscrutable power of Mahashakti, by which material apparitions can be produced, there is a second power. And Hindu Tantra describes this second power of the originator as Mahamaya. And that is the power of the Shakti, or feminine aspect of the originator, to generate the form of the self, thus making discrete experience possible in those material worlds, one self at a time, one view at a time. Even though there is really no single experience in any of those worlds, but there is only the presence of the pure beholding of the originator itself. But if the originator was confined and restricted to be in its own pure beholding, which is undivided, it would be instantly bored. So it would much rather experience its own pure beholding in an infinite faceting of selves, which are frames of beholding. It prefers to look at itself through a frame or a lens or an aperture. But in order to observe itself in that way, it delegates part of its own power to generate that aperture, that lens. And that is called the beauteous form of the self. It is beauteous. So now, in that term beauteous, you might sense that in some manner, this long and elaborate, meandering discourse of mine may return to the subject of the beauty of Persephone. What does the beauty of Persephone have to do with the beauteous form of the self? Beauty is implicated in both of these terms, and you are implicated in the beauty of which I speak. You are deeply implicated in this beauty. There are numerous ways that I could convince you of that implication. But just let me say this right now, at the 1 hour point in this briefing. If you continue to go on from this moment in life with the habit of a subjective self, no matter what you think of yourself, how can you continue in that habit if you do not realize the beauty of having a self at all? We are so used to the habit, to the presence of a self. You know, the self has a content, but I'm not talking about the content of yourself. I'm talking about the frame of it. The self has a content, and if you suffer amnesia or sunstroke, as I did once when I was in Nepal, you can find yourself standing there with no memory of who you are or how you got there, as I stood once on the Lake Pewatal near Pokhara, looking around at the mountains, looking across the lake, with no ability whatsoever to restore any of the content within the frame of myself. But I still had a self. I was still a subjective, observing subject, a subjective self. Now, when you lose the sense of the self entirely, that is the experience that many Asian mystics have reported, and some Western mystics, of the oceanic feeling of loss of self and complete immersion and return, as it were, to the originator, if you want to go there. But why would you go to the place where everything comes from? Because at the place where everything comes from, there's nothing happening. Anyway, that's another issue. Recall the note that I read from the Yeats translations. In Hindu Tantra, the female Shakti power of the originator, called Mahamaya, generates the beauteous form of the self, making discrete experience possible in all those material worlds, one self at a time, one view at a time, even though there really is no single experient in any of those worlds. So you are not a single experient, and neither am I. But how beautiful is it that I can experience myself as if I were? That's not an illusion. That's a gift. And the same gift that comes from the ultimate source of reality, enabling you to know yourself as a subjective consciousness in the world enables the aeons of fire to do the same. So the beauteous form of a self belongs to every living creature. It belongs to the ladybug, to the cat sleeping here on the bed, to elephants, to whales, to human animals, and to planetary animals, like Pam. And the way to realize this Mahamaya power for what it actually is to conceive of yourself as a frame. The self is simply a frame. Suppose that you have a portrait of yourself on the wall, a head and shoulders portrait. And there you are, there's your face, your features. You have a certain expression. You're dressed in a certain way. And when you stand in front of that photo or painting of yourself, you look at it, but you don't necessarily look at the frame. Now, it could be frameless. But in the case of consciousness, it cannot be frameless. You cannot see yourself without a frame. You cannot have an auto portrait, an auto genetic sense of who you are without a frame. And that frame is a creation of the originator through Mahamaya, and it is called the beauteous form of the self. And that is the first beauty. How beautiful it is, even to the originator, to re-experience its own consciousness through the infinite faceting of these frames at every level of existence. So yes, the originator experiences itself in the ladybug and the elephant and the human animal, because each of these is supplied by the originator with a framing device, and the power that provides that device is called Mahamaya. Now, to conclude this briefing, let's return to what I call the identity crisis of the aeons of fire. What exactly was her identity crisis upon the departure of the aeon Christos? Well, she was left alone in her world, in her planet, with her planet, and she was left in a stupor. That is to say, a condition of being stunned. Now, when I first encountered the Aeon Sophia on Infinity Ridge and was able to inaugurate my conversations with her, I realized that the difficulty in conversing with her was exactly the same difficulty that you have with an autistic child. The autistic child is sitting over there on the floor, and you can't get its attention, can you? How do you get the attention of an autistic child? The attention of the Aeon Sophia is autistic, and this autism constitutes a kind of stupor. That is the stupor into which Psyche fell when she opened the casket that contained a portion of the beauty of Persephone. Can you see where I'm starting to go here? Can you see where this is going? Of course, this briefing and the one that follows may well be the most challenging lessons that I've given in the course of the GNE. But this is how to learn something. that can never be unlearned. And this is how to realize something about yourself that connects you directly to the beauty of the entire universe. And the beauteous form of the self does that. And any concept of yourself that doesn't give you that connection is an illusion. It's an illusion. And so what happened to the Aeon Sophia was not that she fell into an illusion about herself when the Aeon Christos left, but she fell back into separation from the Pleroma. She fell back into the loneliness of her particular and anomalous situation. And her identity crisis was exactly like yours. She became self-absorbed, but not narcissistically. The self-absorption of an autistic child is not narcissistic self-absorption, is it? She became self-absorbed with that part of her second attention, the dreaming attention, that wanted to see itself without another aeon to mirror it. And consequently, she fell into a stupor, into a state of autism, in the intensity of looking for the beauteous form of the self, to realize her own beauty. After all, remember, it was a beauty potion. Now, in the second briefing, under 70, under the same title, I will pick up the lesson at exactly this point, clarify it a little more, and then spin it around to the subject of Persephone. So the question to contemplate in the interval between these two briefings, part one and part two of number 70, is the question of the beauty of Persephone and how could that be some particular experience of beauty that the Aeon Sophia was seeking, and can it as well be a particular experience of beauty that you are seeking, even though you don't know that you're seeking it.